listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
In the aftermath of the surprise announcement by President Donald Trump that the U.S. would be pulling all of its troops out of Syria, the UN Security Council heard from its special envoy for Syria, Staffan de Mistura, about his efforts to form what he called a credible, balanced, and inclusive committee to draft a new constitution for Syria before the end of the year. This followed a meeting by de Mistura with the foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, and Turkey. This is Staffan de Mistura briefing the UN Security Council on Thursday.
Mr. President, thank you for this opportunity to deliver my monthly briefing for the final time of this mandate. I am circulating this full written statement to you because, forgive me, for once it's a little bit longer, but there is a reason for that. I've served as special envoy for 4 years and 4 months, almost exactly the length of the First World War. The Syrian people have been enduring a conflict for 7.5 years, longer than the Second World War. This conflict has been and remains a tragedy for the Syrian people. It has been dirty, brutal, horrific war. It has seen all the faultiness within Syria, the region, the world prevail so far rather than the will of the Syrian people, Syrian unity, regional stability, and international cooperation. No effort, not mine, not yours, not anyone else has been able to completely stop the logic of war prevailing. But we hope we are getting very close to that. In spite of several ceasefires and some moments of real hope, the battlefield has all too often prevailed over peace talks. And it has been constantly shifting. But ultimately, the question will be, and is, and now is the time to look at it even more so, will peace be won? We believe it should, and it can. Will it be sustainable? We believe it can, and it should. That is why a real political process is required. You, the Security Council, outlined in Resolution 2254 the elements for the political process. You exclusively mandated the UN to convene the parties, to facilitate the political process, to finalize participation with full respect of Syria's sovereignty, with respect of the ability of the Syrian people to choose their own representatives, with the purpose of enabling the Syrian people independently and democratically to determine their own future. And while stressing at the same time the vital parallel importance of a nationwide ceasefire. With this mandate, I believe we have made some difference, but not enough, we have to be frank. But we have made some difference, and you with us, and we with you. We have saved lives with some ceasefires and de-escalations, no matter how limited in scope and time, and they did save lives and stimulated humanitarian access to places where they were not getting it, but nowhere near what civilians desperately needed and asked for. We have convened the government and opposition and also helped the process of uniting the opposition. But we have not yet, and we have to admit it, had the parties really recognize each other as interlocutors with whom they must be doing business, actually negotiate, let alone reach agreements. We have elaborated with the parties key principles for a common future and settlement, but we have not yet turned these into real mechanisms for implementation. We have identified a clear agenda accepted by the parties that would facilitate negotiation, but we have not yet been able to tap into its potential. We have with determination promoted the involvement of Syrian women in the search for a peaceful settlement to the crisis. They know what the country is facing. They are more than half of the population, even though this is still constantly challenged. We have with equal determination promoted the meaningful inclusion and substantive participation of civil society, but this too is constantly challenged. We have nearly completed the work of putting in place a constitutional committee to draft a constitutional reform as a contribution to the political process, but there is still an extra mile to go. We know what is needed for a safe, calm, neutral environment in Syria and for UN-supervised elections to the highest international standards pursuant to a new reformed constitution. But we have not been able to begin the full work required to make that a reality. I deeply regret what has not been achieved, and I'm sorry more could have been done and was not possible. I think we in the Security Council together should share that regret too, and I know we do it. But we have identified and put in place some of the key building blocks on which the future process can build. My successor has all the skills and ability to work out what combination of continuity and change is required. He was my successor in Lebanon. He did better than me. He is a friend, someone we all respect, and we have tested, and you, many of you know. So I'm very confident about what I'm saying. But make no mistake, as with my own predecessors, and let me here pay respect, deep respect, to Kofi Annan and to Lakhdar Brahimi. As with my own predecessors and me, his success will depend on your unity and purpose to empower and support the UN and pressure all parties to begin real dialogue, negotiation and compromise to address the grievances of the Syrian people and implement Resolution 2254. Mr. President, following the passage of Resolution 2254, we did see serious attempt to put in place a ceasefire and cooperate in countering terrorism, which is and continues is and will be the priority of all of us because it's been threatening everyone in this room and beyond. And to support the Geneva talks on a political transition via the International Syria Support Group. But that promise has not been yet fulfilled. The unity here was not strong enough yet. And the forces which have been trying to complicate peacemaking have been proving sometimes stronger. By the start of 2017, Iran, Russia and Turkey committed to cooperate in Astana on de-escalation and confidence building, with Jordan, the U.S., the Russian Federation beginning to work on de-escalation in the southwest later in the year. The results were mixed. Lives, however, were saved. And there were three of the four de-escalation arrangements which did stand and then sadly came to an end. However, there were also lives lost. One of these areas was held and is still held in, and we are all supporting that arrangement, Idlib, with more than 3 million civilians. Meantime, results on detainees, abductees and missing people fell short of hopes. Despite the establishment of a working group in December, which is always better than nothing, and we have to recognize that, it did produce a first concrete but modest movement recently. It is, however, at least seeing from the point of view of the Syrian people, the thousands and thousands of families, it is unacceptable that tens of thousands languish in detention or remain unaccounted for amid fear, torture or death or being not knowing where they are. So we have never had for any length of time the so-called nationwide ceasefire or the real confidence building that the Resolution 2254 envisaged along the side of Geneva political talks, but we got often close to it. Despite this, the UN-facilitated Geneva talks identified a clear agenda of four baskets, and you're very familiar with them, but we should record them because we don't want to lose that which has been achieved. Four baskets of issues based on Resolution 2254. They did produce 12 living intra-Syrian essential principles developed with the extensive input of the government, the opposition, and with consultation with a wide cross-section of civil society and Syrian women. These principles, the 12 principles, are a brick on which my successor can work on. These principles offer a vision of the future of Syria that can be shared by all, and they provide carefully crafted formulas on key issues that in fact can be the basis for future work. For instance, sovereignty and unity, governance, democracy, separation of powers, human rights, religion and state, decentralization, measures against terrorism, respect for all Syrian components, and the full participation of women, the right of refugees to return to their homes and lands, and so on. Logically, a Syrian-owned and Syrian-led political process with UN facilitation must secure the actual realization in practice, not only words, of this principle through agreements, mechanisms, and concrete steps guided by Resolution 2254. As was recognized at the presidential level between the United States and the Russian Federation in Da Nang in November 2017, a constitutional reform and a UN-supervised election in a safe, neutral environment opens the way to concretely implement Resolution 2254. And as indicated to you a year and a day ago, when I briefed you on 19 September 2017, the UN has identified via Basket 2 and 3 of the Geneva process 11 parameters. They are in my written copy that I will give you, for constitution making, and 6 insights on supervised UN elections. These were, in my own assessment, broad commonalities that could guide the parties and that would, in any case, guide the UN and my successor as a facilitator. Mr. President, by the end of 2017, Russia, Turkey and Iran were preparing to convene a gathering of Syrians in Sochi. I attended Sochi at the guidance of the Secretary General. In light of the understanding that the Secretary General and myself reached in Vienna with the Russian Federation diplomats, as to how Sochi would make a contribution by enabling the UN to establish under its auspices in Geneva a key piece of architecture of the broader process that the realization of 2254 requires. The Sochi final statement, which the Russian Federation circulated in this chamber to this Council as an official document, affirmed the 12 principles as the basis for the political settlement. It called for a formation of a constitutional committee with the purpose of drafting of a constitutional reform as a contribution to the political settlement under the UN auspices in accordance with the Security Council Resolution 2254. I underline to you the word contribution. Thus, the Constitutional Committee can be a key building block of a real political process, an important entry point, if you will, but certainly not the only one. Syrians know that, you know that, I know that. It was agreed in Sochi that such a committee would be, at least, very least, comprise government, opposition representatives in the intra-Syrian talks, Syrian experts, civil society, independents, tribal leaders, and women. And that care would be taken to ensure adequate representation of Syria ethnic and religious components. And that final agreement, quote unquote, is to be reached in the UN-led Geneva process on the mandate, terms of reference, powers, rules of procedure, and selection criteria for the composition of the Constitutional Committee. To this end, the Sochi final statement appealed, quote, to the UN Secretary General to assign the Special Envoy for Syria for the assistance of the Constitutional Committee work in Geneva, end of quote. Russia and the UN clearly understood that the Special Envoy facilitated that process and enjoyed the finalization prerogatives in the formation of a Constitutional Committee, and would have been able to identify members of that committee from a Sochi pool of candidates, as well draw on other people from outside this pool, if required, to ensure a credible and balanced committee. The UN facilitation of that process was the clear basis of moving forward. Mr. President, since Sochi, I've been, during the period of almost 1 year, undertaking a marathon of consultations with Syrian and international stakeholders, in particular the Sochi conveners, co-conveners, to enable the establishment of a Syrian-owned, Syrian-led, UN-facilitated, balanced, inclusive, and credible constitutional committee. I shall not recount all the steps of the diplomacy, but let me reiterate the key points so that we know where we stand before I pass it on to my successor. One, the government and the opposition have conveyed 50 names each and agreed not to question the 50 names of the other. Two, it was accepted that there should be 50 names in the middle third, meeting the Sochi final statement criterion. Three, it was accepted that this would then, therefore, see a constitutional committee of 150. Five, it was accepted that a drafting body of maximum 45 would be identified with each 15 each from each third group. It was accepted that the conducive chairing, decision-making arrangements needed to be clearly identified, and it was affirmed that the Constitutional Committee would be convened under UN auspices in Geneva. Next, the UN put forward 5 months ago a consolidated proposal or proposed middle third list based on credibility, balance, inclusivity, including aiming at the overall minimum of 30% women in the Constitutional Committee. The opposition did not like completely this list, but agreed not to question it in the spirit of moving forward. The government had strong objections to this list and indicated that it would work with the Sochi conveners on a different list and that the UN should await that input. Well, The leaders of France, Germany, Russia, and Turkey agreed in Istanbul on the 27th of October that the end of December should be a target, considering the circumstances, for establishing the Constitutional Committee. And the Secretary General tasked me before moving on to verify whether it was possible to establish a credible, balanced, including Syrian-owned, Syrian-led, UN-facilitated constitutional committee to draft for popular approval a constitutional reform and to fundamentally advance that objective. To overcome the government's concern while not losing the opposition and maintaining the quality and legitimacy of the overall package, I indicated the UN would be receptive to modest, credible, balanced proposals while bearing in mind the UN's mandate and responsibility in the context of the need to finalize this package. It is, we understand, for the UN a big responsibility because it is to exercise its mandate and is expected not to accept any type of imposition regarding convening the SCC or finalizing the package. Well, in recent weeks, diplomacy beyond the UN Secretariat has intensified, leading to a meeting that I hosted in Geneva on Tuesday with the foreign ministers of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Russian Federation, and the Republic of Turkey. And the Secretary General was closely involved throughout. The three foreign ministers offered to the UN a significant joint input regarding the Constitutional Committee. That significant joint input comprised 50 names, drawing partly from my own suggestion and as their own proposal for the third middle list of the Constitutional Committee. The UN, having examined the UN Secretariat, the names, assessed that we would not feel totally comfortable yet in giving the UN stamp of legitimacy to all of the 50 names as meeting the necessary criteria of credibility and balance. Hence, our own suggestion, the need for going an extra mile. We have seen the loss of some experienced experts and of excellent credentials who would have also been natural bridge builders. So no list, we know it, will be ever perfect. But in our assessment, the list needed a further review and some extra mile. There is also a need to identify with more precision the remainder of the package with the parties on board so that the Constitutional Committee, when it meets, can effectively function, delivering outcomes in line with its own mandate as a genuine instrument within a larger political process towards sustainable peace. In this respect, my consultations leave me confident that it should be possible to agree on a 75% voting threshold and balanced co-chairmanship arrangement. And if I may add, regardless of who would be the chairperson, if one is from the government, the co-chair should be from at least the opposition and should be either one or the other a woman. They represent 51%, or if not 55% of the population. My consultation leave me also confident that it is understood that the Constitutional Committee would draft a constitutional reform and the UN would have the crucial role in accompanying and facilitating this Syrian-owned process. It is also crucial to identify how the smaller drafting group or drafting body would be selected and begin to work. The party therefore need to buy in also these key details. So, let me be frank. I know we always look at the glass, how full, how empty. There has been and there is real progress. We nearly have a list. The rules of procedure become a little bit clear, but we need to go that extra mile. If a constitutional committee is established, it would be done with the blessing, of course, of the Security Council. That would have happened anyway. And it would be vital for this council to support regular reviews of the progress of the committee's work and any adjustment required along the road in order to help the Syrian-owned, Syrian-led constitutional committee, according to the implementation of 2254. Mr. President, the UN alone has the legitimacy and mandate to bless, at least at the first stage, the constitutional community given the circumstance in Syria, and that is the Security Council. This is accompanied by parallel efforts to ensure a full ceasefire, see detainees and abductees released at a scale, build confidence, create a safe, calm, neutral environment with reforms of governance, and lay the ground for UN-supervised elections, as per 2254. In this regard, and contrary to the spirit of building mutual confidence, we have been very concerned sometimes at recent and credible reports of some type of intimidation and coercion of people reportedly on the list for the Constitutional Committee and their family members inside Syria. This has been more frequent in the recent days, and we are frankly considering this very worrisome. This is a fundamental reminder, therefore, for the need of concrete steps on what we call safe, calm, and neutral environment. And that, Mr. President, will be one of the questions that refugees also and internally displaced people have been telling us in no uncertain terms. We want a safe, neutral environment. People will consider returning when they feel safe, if their fundamental rights are protected, if they can reunite with their families in the areas they came from, if their property and other legal rights are preserved and institutions of the state protect such rights, if basic social services will be delivered and there will be no political prejudice or bias. The list of legitimate questions don't end here, Mr. President. All these and other questions are key to the establishment of a calm, safe and neutral environment. Mr. President, if we are able to start a constitutional committee, it will be a new test of political will. Will the government engage seriously and show a willingness to address real grievances which have been at the beginning the origin of this horrible conflict? Will the opposition engage seriously, realistically, realizing that the process of changing Syria will not be an easy one, but it needs them to realize to be also pragmatic? I urge them both to do so. There is no other way out of this Syrian conflict. Let me commend the voices of the Syrians beyond the garden and the opposition working for peace against all odds. Many participate in the civil society support room, which we have created in partnership with Syrians who committed to the values of peace. And indeed, many are meeting with my team this week in regional capitals. I therefore must urge you, members of this Council, the international community and Syrian parties more broadly, to listen to their voices, even when I will not be there. They are important. Protect them and involve them meaningfully in the long and challenging road forward. I salute them, I mean the Syrian civilians, and thank them for their efforts, willingness to engage with us and with you all. Let me stress also the crucial role, once again, of women in the Syrian political process. This is not lip service. I've seen them. They had enormous influence and they were given a chance and they can be given more chance to do so. I've done everything I could to promote this with the delegation and within civil society. I've been assisted by a women's advisory board whose membership has recently rotated and been renewed. Advisory Women's Board is a model for what is possible when Syrians from different backgrounds come together to accompany the mediation process. And I can see this is also being now replicated on the Yemen file. The women in Syria have been continuing reminding me of what is possible and continue to plead for a process that is fully inclusive of all Syrian society with the full participation of women and everyone else. I fought and will continue to fight to ensure at least 30% representation of women in the Constitutional Committee, and I hope to see that realized. That's why the emphasis also in the co-chairmanship. Mr. President, you are the Security Council, so let me stress one point above all. The UN, as a facilitator and mediator, can create every sort of mediation process, every sort of dialogue, whether secret talks, back channels, proximity talks, technical talks, working groups, direct talks, multi-party talks, constitutional committees, national dialogues, and so on. I've sought to bridge international divides with ideas, messages, channels, meetings, and by framing a way forward that all could sign on to consistently support our mandate. I've also sought to speak publicly and clearly about the shocking violence and abuses against civilians, the need for humanitarian access, and the need to counter terrorism, and the fundamental importance of respecting international humanitarian law. But that is no substitute for genuine efforts of influential countries to talk to each other and to work constructively within this council and beyond in support of a UN process and a Syrian-led and owned process. It is this council, and this council alone, that is responsible for the maintenance of international peace and security. You have mandated the UN to facilitate the intra-Syrian political process for implementation of Resolution 2254. That is the only way to enable the Syrians to determine their own future. And we need a renewed sense of common purpose and concerted action in this council if 2019 is to be the real turning point for Syria. In closing, Mr. President, I would like to thank my Secretary General, our Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, for his trust, advice, and encouragement, and my own team, who over the last 4 years and a half have been working tirelessly to keep the talks process alive, moving forward, sometimes simply incrementally, but never giving up. I owe them enormously. I'm convinced that the UN staff tenacity and ingenuity can make a fundamental difference for Syria. And I wish my successor all the success in his vital work. It has been a real privilege, honor, to work with each one of you, members of this council. And in spite of your own divisions, you have always had one line, and I've felt it constantly. You have been consistently supporting our complex mission, myself, and I want to thank you very warmly for that. Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Not long ago, the political left were the guardians of free speech. Along with big tech, the left today has gone from protecting speech to enforcing speech, even to the point of penalizing you if you say the wrong thing in public. You can lose your job and livelihood. Welcome to the era of simply shut up and nod. Crosstalking enforced speech. I'm joined by my guest, Emmanuelle Gave in Paris. She is a French lawyer. In New York, we have Lionel. He is a legal analyst and a news decoder at LionelMedia.com. And in Lake Jackson, we cross to Daniel McAdams. He is the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. All right, let me go to Daniel first here. We're pretty much the same age here. I remember growing up, and it was a time of being sensitive to people, let's put it that way. There are certain words in our vocabulary, I'm sure it probably exists in French as well, is that things you don't say. And I think you know what I'm talking about. And you know what? I thought that was all right. I think that's cool. Yep. All right? All right. But in the last few days, we had a Virginia teacher fired for using the preferred pronoun of a student. And then we had a Texas elementary school teacher who refused to sign a pro-Israel oath is fired. Now, this is enforcing speech. It is not protecting speech. How did we get here? Go ahead, Daniel.
Well, I think we got here partially with the idea that somehow the state could keep all of us safe. And I hate to draw everything back to foreign policy, but I think a lot of it had to do with the concept of preemptive warfare, the idea that through the application of force, we could create a perfect society. And I think that concept, that idea has permeated, unfortunately now permeates the left, to weaponize our own thoughts, to weaponize our own thought processes. If you control what someone must say, exactly, then you control how they think, you control their mind. So I think it comes from the idea that the use of force is okay if it makes you safe. And of course, ultimately, as we know from foreign policy and from force speech, it doesn't make you safe.
Well, Emmanuel, I mean, what is happening right now is not, it's simply a rejection of the very foundation of Western civilization. Now, I know there's a lot of millennials in all of Hollywood and all of the universities hate the idea of Western civilization, but they have everything they have now because of Western civilization, a topic from another program. But they want to deny freedom of speech, and they are intentionally, actively undermining freedom of speech. Emmanuel in Paris, please.
Yes, well, actually, if you think about it, somehow there's maybe nothing new under the sun, because if you think about the logos, since the ancient Greek philosopher, since Aristotle, Socrates, Plato, it has always been said that he who controls the logos would control the political life of the country.
Right.
And we have seen that best than ever in the 1984 George Orwell, when they create the Newspeak. So now we have this whole population in Hollywood that you were referring to, of people that are in a way orphans of the late tyranny of the late that was USSR. So they thought, well, what could we invest? And they thought, well, we will invest in a new type of world. We will create our Newspeak, and we'll make this new war about one side is the planet and the other side is this gender war, and trying to put against all the values we have, the notion of country, the notion of family, even the word of nation. And it has been done for centuries, if you think about it. And dictators in Europe have been very good at creating new languages, from Hitler to the USSR in the old days. So controlling the logos, in a way, is something that Antonio Gramsci, the Italian philosopher, used to say. Control the world of the education, the words, and one generation later, you will have the power in politics. And this is what is happening, which is why we need us conservative, to react and say, no, we all know what you're doing, guys. We've seen it before.
Yeah, what they'll try to do is they'll get you fired, okay, or you'll have to go somewhere else. Lionel, the wordsmith on our panel here, I mean, Daniel hit the nail on the head here. This is a form of mind control, and as I said in my introduction, and if you don't agree, then you have to shut up and nod, okay, or there'll be penalties, and they're serious ones. Go ahead, Lionel.
Well, we have, you know, in the world of nature, normally things go extinct or become extinct. Here, we have new species that pop up. And these new species, these new chimeras, are an amalgam of social justice warriors, virtue signalers, and others who get together and they create what I call not the thought police, but the thought vigilantes. And what they are is these are citizen mobs, ochlocracies, as Gustave Le Bon would talk about this herd mentality, like murmurations of sparrows and starlings, that they move. And today, the more allergies you have, the more sensitivities you show, the more that you can show, I'm upset by this word, here are my allergies. I don't know if you've ever met these people, but they're not this. These are people who show allergies to this word. I have a new word. My pronoun is, that's the way you say it. It's a clicking sound. And if you don't say that, I will not only disagree with you, I'll have you fired and removed from humanity. Now, I move up the pecking order because I have another allergy, another overreaction, and I am more upset and angry over this. And we turn this into a fad. It's how many allergies do you have? We should have like a fruit salad like they have in the military to show how many words and how many things upset and annoy you. That's really how we are. It's the thought vigilantes.
You know, Daniel, it's you know, not only the rejection of freedom of speech, but actually the rule of law. This is what I find terrifying. Look what happened to during the Kavanaugh hearings. Okay, this was this herd, and it was one of the most profound moments, I think, or an indication of how far it's gone. An accusation is a conviction. If you don't call me something that I want, then you're a transphobe or a bigot or a racist. I mean, this is this amazing slippery slope, and it has real consequences, because then you do lose the rule of law and the right to self-protection. I mean, I'm offended every time I turn on cable news, okay? But that's okay to be offended. When you're offended, you learn, okay? That's how I know how to push back, okay? Listening to all their jargon, they do not want you to think, they want you to repeat. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, and I think the core of this is really the rise of the concept of collective rights versus what's been cherished in Western civilization, individual rights, individual liberties, and with that goes individual responsibilities, which you alluded to, of course, at first, words that you would not say because you're a polite person. But the whole concept of collective rights is about the destruction of the individual. It's about using force to force someone else. And if you are using that force, if the individual no longer has any value as an individual, then truth itself doesn't matter. And I'm glad you brought up the Kavanaugh hearings, because even when falsehoods were exposed, the adherence to this group rights mentality said it doesn't matter if they were lying. The concept of what they were pushing was right. And I think it's fortunate that we have a French guest here, because I think a lot of this idea goes back to the French Revolution. The whole concept of truth, the whole concept of reality, of existence, was turned on its head. And that's what we're seeing now with the rise of collective rights. Collective rights really is another word for authoritarianism and tyranny.
Emmanuel, how do you see that? I mean, we're basically three Americans and we have a French person, so maybe you could give you the angle there. Go ahead.
No, I think it's very true to look at it. I mean, looking at it from my European perspective, I see that it's the first time in common law history that you have what we call in French une obligation de faire, which means you are obligated to do something, usually from freedom of speech. And the case law that was developed from the Supreme Court was to say there is nothing that refrains you from your freedom of speech. The only thing, it shouldn't be a hate incentive. But right now, for example, looking at the federal laws that have been passed in Canada, the idea now is that if you do not use the pronoun, it will be considered as a hate crime. So you have a total inversion of the proof, of the system of proof. You now have, as a person, if you're a teacher and you do not use the pronoun, to maybe prove in a court of law that your reality, what you see with your eyes, but you're going to have to take a lawyer to plead that, to say that you cannot say something that you don't see, which actually seems like common sense. It's very difficult but that's what they want to do. They want to enforce on someone something that seems unreal. It's a little bit like in the time of Galileo, you know, when he used to come to the Catholic Church and say, "E per si muovo," but it moves. It's the same idea. He looks at the planet and says, "But no, look, it is turning. It's not the sun that is going around the earth. It's the other way around. It is moving." But they said, "No, this is not the reality, because us Catholic Church, we have the real logo." And it's the same thing today. Those people, those progressists, they want to tell us that what we see as real is not really real. How come? Why? I don't see why they have the truth. They don't want to stay in an empirical demonstration.
Well, I mean, and also, let me finish up here with Emmanuel. I mean, empirical reality is being denied. And this is what's really quite terrifying. I mean, if I tell you I'm a salad bowl and I want you to call me a salad bowl, I mean, then you would probably think I was out of my mind. But if we were in Canada, well, I suppose that's a gender category right now. A salad bowl, okay? It is just absolutely preposterous.
Did you see lately?
Go ahead. 20 seconds. Go ahead.
There was a case in Denmark. Yes, there was a case in Denmark just recently where a man wanted to change his age because he considered he was not 63 but felt Yes, because he felt he was 43. So he was acting, asking to change on the register.
Well,
because
no, he was,
said, that's what I
he
feel
was
like.
Looking for dates
what's,
on
what's
he was looking for
that?
Dates on Tinder. Okay. All right, I'm gonna jump in here. We're gonna go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on enforced speech. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let's go back to Lionel in New York. This enforced speech concept, what it does is it denies dissent, and it actually denies real political debate because the terms and conditions of the debate are predetermined. So the outcome, if you control the language, you will get the outcome you want because you've already predetermined the outcome using a very confined and controlled discourse. Go ahead, Lionel.
One of the topic of hate crimes came up and hate speech came up. And one of the problems that is always missed is that in our country, we will take a law that is cognizable at law, let's say battery or arson or murder, that is punishable. And we will then take that, and if you couple it with something that is constitutionally allowed, permissible, for example, to hate, Peter, yep. I may hate you. It's okay. Just don't hurt you, touch you, or call you salad bowl in a mean way. But I can hate. So if you take something that is already a law and you aggravate it, basically you aggravate the sentence or the charge because I've dared to add to it a constitutionally permissible thought, namely hate, you're penalizing thought. The thought police are very, very alive here. Very interesting also. You take these poor prosecutors, of which I was one, and it's tough enough to prove the case. But, Peter, not only now must I prove that you intended to do something, but I've got to prove to a jury why you did it. And if you are very clever and yeah. you keep your mouth shut or you do not record the motivation behind your hate speech, then I have to guess. And what I'm doing is I'm asking a jury to penalize you, not just for what you did, but yeah. for what you thought. This yeah. is already going on right now, and the worst part is Americans don't even see it.
Okay, well, Daniel, intentionality is almost impossible to prove, but I guess now that's turning into a legal category all by itself. Ask General Flynn. Okay, but I want to go back. I want to go back to this this attack on dissent. It is outlawing dissent, and the political discourse is so confined right now that if you don't meet the terms and conditions of the debate that they want, then you can't participate. You're disqualified automatically. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I think, it does go back to the idea of group rights and what happens with group rights. Who gets group rights? Well, the loudest people get group rights. The loudest groups get group rights. And how do they enforce those group rights? Which, of course, always come at the expense of the individual. They enforce it through the state. They use the state as their bludgeon. So what does that do to us as individuals? It makes us literally the property of the state. We go back to a concept that was certainly wide throughout the Soviet Union, and I remember still talked about in Hungary when I lived there, the concept of the wooden language. We begin adopting a wooden language because we're afraid to speak in a clear way. We're afraid of who we might offend, and so we actually end up destroying the language itself, and I think that's absolutely where we're heading, and the concept is group rights. But people should realize that the totalitarians that are pushing this should realize once they establish the concept of group rights, those groups can change, and we know through history, favored groups can become disfavored groups. There's already a backlash in Europe and in the United States. Thankfully, it's not yet violent. But if you look at the popularity of someone like Jordan Peterson, for example,
yep.
the professor from Canada, his huge following of silent, I would say silent majority who can sense there is something wrong
yep.
And are afraid to speak out. And so they follow someone like that. So I think you're already seeing a backlash.
Yes, I agree. And I go to Emmanuel in Paris. Jordan Peterson is a perfect example. Is that, you know, what he says is really not quite extraordinary. It's so common sense, and it is so clear. And you intuitively understand. It's like, yeah, that's what I've been thinking all along, okay? Emmanuel, one of the things, I lived in communist Poland. Daniel said that he went to communist Hungary. The, you know, and the language was wooden. He's absolutely right. But the difference in the West is that it's all glitzy and glamorous, okay? And it's virtuous, okay? You get the big tech censoring people, throttling people, disappearing people. Hollywood pushes their nonsense agenda, amoral, illogical. They're at the very center of this, and governments work with them here. I mean, it's we have the good thing is it might be a circular firing squad. All we have to do is duck every once in a while. My point is the array of forces against free speech are immense. Go ahead in Paris.
Yes, I think in a way, if you think about it, in the last 30 years, changes from W. Bush to Obama, it was the same logos. They were all using the wooden tongue, as you were referring. But I have great hope in the sense that I might not be a Trump lover on everything, but Mr. Trump, President Trump, when he came to power on the back of a very different and new logo. He calls a cat a cat, and when he doesn't like something, he says it loud and clear. So I think a lot of the power that came within Mr. Trump is also the redefinition of common sense. He doesn't use a very special word or anything. And in my French view, when I look at President Macron, he is the opposite of that. He's somebody who was made totally artificially. And we see that with the common people, which is why we had this gilets jaunes crisis, the yellow vest, because people are aware nowadays that there is such a difference between them and this type of oligarchy, which is really something that could come from communist Russia in the days, or from Hungary or Poland. It's this caste, and we have that in Brussels also. This caste of very, very chosen elite, with their logo, their speech, and they decided one day to think of a world that would be transgender and that would be post-humanist. And if us citizens, we have something to say about it, well, they might consider it, but maybe they have another day plan, agenda.
Because, Emmanuel, so it's because,
I think
it's because
what comes around comes around.
Because they're morally superior to us, right? That's what they believe. Deep down, they believe that they're morally superior to us. Let me go to Lionel. You know what the yellow vest found out? They found out that Macron's brain is made of cork, okay? They found out, okay? And it is, okay? It's not even wood. It's cork. It's even less quality, poorer quality. Lionel, Emmanuel said she's optimistic. I'm not very optimistic here because of the array of forces that are against it. I mean, if you look at these social media platforms, they can disappear you in broad daylight. Okay, you can lose your job for using the wrong a pronoun. I mean, I can't go back and live in the U.S. I don't know. I probably get arrested at the airport for some reason. Go ahead, Lionel.
Oh, I would highly advise against that, Peter. I'm your dear friend. I would stay put. Let me just put it. But let me tell you this much, though. You know, when you see a teacher who is in a kindergarten class or who is in a class for shop or something, and the teacher has to swear not to promote anything that would impede Israeli trade, and you're wondering, what does this have to do with kindergarten? Or why is this important to use a particular word? I'm teaching shop. The reason why I'm not at all optimistic, in fact, I'm pessimistic, is that right now in our culture here, it is a sign of, it's like the neck tattoo. I used to laugh. I would say there's no way people will ever tattoo their face and mar their face permanently. Well, so much for that.
So
something becomes fashionable, and now people, as you know, we're having snowflakes and people use various terms, but it is now becoming fashionable. And I hope that one day this mighty pendulum swings the other way, but I don't think it's going to be for a while. Because right now I am applauded by me having more, for example, you know, these allergies where I am against the following and where I tell you I will sit back in a class or at my work and I will wait for you to comment, say anything. And not only am I going to be applauded for being hypersensitive and not only having you reprimanded, but removed, expunged, obliterated, ablated, you know, disappeared, but I'm going to be held to a higher societal status because I'm showing my peers I am more sensitive than you.
Oh,
I am more easily offended than you, and therefore I maintain a higher position.
Yeah, you know, Daniel, this whole identitarian political strategy, it caves in on itself. I mean, you put everybody in these little boxes or little tribes and all that, and then you look for the least advantages, the most virtuous. I mean, it is Marxism to its core. It's just, it's the same old bottle with new wine, okay? Identitarian politics inevitably caves in on itself. Okay, and it's only a matter of time here. I mean, I take the Benedict option and just stand aside and watch these people destroy themselves, because they will. Inevitably, they will. Go ahead, Daniel.
Well, it does go back to the concept of trying to achieve perfect safety. You talk about coming back to the U.S. You may not get arrested, but when you get here, you're going to have some guy groping you, whacking your genitals, taking away all of your individual rights because they got to keep you safe. And that's the idea. But, you know, I come down in between being pessimistic and optimistic. I think it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Yeah.
But I think it will ultimately get better. Just look at the issue with the Texas teacher. All of a sudden, people are waking up saying, hold on, in 26 states in the U.S., I'm not allowed to say I'd rather not buy Israeli products because I don't like their internal policies. What the hell is that about? I'm an American.
Daniel,
and I think you're going to have a lot more people starting to think about it.
What is interesting is that at least now, Americans can criticize their own government, but they're not allowed to criticize a foreign government. What is going on with that?
Exactly. You can even call for the overthrow of your own government. You just can't say, don't buy Israeli goods because they're terrible to Palestinians. I think people are going to wake up. I think common sense will prevail. Unfortunately, a lot of the churches in the U.S. Dominate people's thinking when it comes to the Middle East, in my opinion, inaccurately. But I think thinking people will start to realize this is insane. This whole concept of forced speech is insane.
Well, you know, I hope that everyone on this program knows and will come back to it, because there's always a space for free speech, not enforced speech, on this program. Many thanks to my guests in Paris, New York, and in Lake Jackson. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio. .org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.